back for our second segment here on Radio Parallax. I wanted to read you for the past 2 weeks a soldier's viewpoint on surviving nuclear, chemical, and biological attacks. This was sent to us in an email by Roger S. Peterson, who was our guest back in August. It's a very good piece. It may take a little bit of time to read, but I think it's worth going over. So, let's do it. This is an open letter from Sergeant First Class Red Thomas, retired, who is describes himself as an Armor Master Gunner from Mesa, Arizona. Sergeant Thomas specifically says that unlimited reproduction and distribution is authorized. Just give me credit for my work and keep it in context. I'm not going to read the entirety of the document, but I'll be excerpting it quite heavily. All right. The writings of Sergeant First Class Red Thomas. Since the media has decided to scare everyone with predictions of chemical, biological, or nuclear warfare on our turf, I decided to write a paper and keep things in their proper perspective. I am a retired military weapons, munitions, and training expert. Lesson number one. In the mid-1990s, there were a series of nerve gas attacks on crowded Japanese subway stations. Less than 10% of the people there were injured, and only 1% of the injured died. Forget everything you've ever seen on TV, in the movies, or read in a novel about this stuff. It was all a lie. These weapons are about terror. If you remain calm, you will probably not die. This is far less scary than the media and their, quote, experts, unquote, make it sound. Chemical weapons are categorized as nerve, blood, blister, and incapacitating agents. Contrary to the hype of reporters and politicians, they are not weapons of mass destruction. They are, quote, area denial, unquote, and terror weapons that don't destroy anything. When you leave the area, you almost always leave the risk. These are not gases. They are vapors and or airborne particles. They've got to get this stuff on you or get you to inhale it for it to work. They also have to get the concentration of chemicals high enough to kill or wound you. Too little and it's nothing. Too much and it's wasted. What I hope you've gathered by this point is that a chemical weapons attack that kills a lot of people, is incredibly hard to do with military-grade agents and equipment. So you can imagine how hard it will be for terrorists. The more you know about this stuff, the more you realize how hard it is to use. Let's start by talking about nerve agents. You have these in your house. Plain old bug killer, like Raid, is a nerve agent. All nerve agents work the same way. They are cholinesterase inhibitors that mess up the signals your nervous system uses to make your body function. It can harm you if you get it on your skin, but it works best if they can get you to inhale it. If you don't die in the first minute and you can leave the area, you're probably going to live. The military's antidote for all nerve agents is atropine and pralidoxime chloride. Neither one of these does anything to cure the nerve agent, but they send your body into overdrive to keep you alive for 5 minutes. After that, the agent is used up. Your best protection is fresh air and staying calm. The symptoms for nerve agent poisoning? Sudden headache. Dimness of vision. Someone you're looking at will have pinpointed pupils. Runny nose. Excessive saliva or drooling. Difficulty breathing, tightness in chest, nausea, stomach cramps. If you are in public and you start experiencing these symptoms, first, ask yourself, did anything out of the ordinary just happen? Is there an odor of new mown hay, green corn, something fruity, or camphor where it shouldn't be? If the answer is yes, then calmly. If you panic, you breathe faster and inhale more air poison. Calmly leave the area and head upwind or outside. This stuff works based on your body weight. What a crop duster uses to kill bugs won't hurt you unless you stand there and breathe it in real deep, then lick the residue off the ground for a while. Remember, they have to do all the work. They have to get the concentration up and keep it up for several minutes, while all you have to do is to quit getting it on you, quit breathing it by putting space between you and the attack. Blood agents are cyanide or arsine, which affects your body's ability to provide oxygen to your tissue. The scenario for attack would be the same as a nerve agent. Look for a pop or someone splashing or spraying something around, and folks around getting woozy or falling down. The telltale smells are bitter almonds or garlic where it shouldn't be. The symptoms are blue lips, blue under the fingernails, and rapid breathing. The military's antidote is amyl nitrate, and just like nerve agent antidotes, it keeps your body working for 5 minutes till the toxins are used up. Fresh air is your best individual chance. Blister agents are so nasty that nobody wants to handle them, let alone use them. They're almost impossible to handle safely. If there is an attack, leave the area and go upwind. They have to get the stuff on you, and you're more likely to be hurt by a drunk driver on any given day than hurt by one of these attacks. Your odds get better if you leave the area. Soap, water, time, and fresh air really deal this stuff a knockout punch. Don't let fear of an isolated attack rule your life. The odds really are on your side. Now, at this point, I would like to mention that among the chemical weapons, Sergeant Thomas addresses nerve, blood, and blister agents, but has nothing to say about incapacitating agents. In our talk with Dr. Mark Wheelis here at UC Davis, which aired 2 weeks ago in the program, we did talk a bit about that and didn't air that. So I think that we will, after finishing reading this, delve into that topic a bit. Now, to return to what Sergeant Thomas has to say about nuclear weapons. These are the only weapons of mass destruction on Earth. The effects of a nuclear bomb are heat, blast, electromagnetic pulse, and radiation. If you see a bright flash of light like the sun, where the sun isn't, fall to the ground. The heat will be over a second. Then there will be two blast waves, one outgoing and one on its way back. Don't stand up to see what happened after the first wave. Anything that's going to happen will have happened in 2 full minutes. These will be low-yield devices and will not level whole cities. If you live through the heat, blast, and initial burst of radiation, you're probably going to live for a very, very long time. According to the sergeant, if this happens, these will be at the most 1 kiloton bombs. Under perfect conditions, this is about a half-mile circle of death and destruction. But when it's done, it's done. You just got to try and avoid inhaling dust that's contaminated with atoms that are emitting ionizing radiation, and you'll generally be safe. Your defense is, as always, not to panic. All canned or frozen foods are safe to eat. Radiation poisoning will not affect plants, so fruits and vegetables are okay if there's no dust on them. Rinse them off if there is. Finally, there's biological warfare. There's not much to cover here. Basic personal hygiene and sanitation will take you further than a million doctors. If biological warfare was as easy as TV makes it sound, why has Saddam Hussein spent 20 years and millions of dollars trying to get it right? So overall, preparation for any terrorist attack is the same as you take for a big storm. Have a week's worth of cash, several days' worth of canned goods, and plenty of soap and water. There are millions of caveats to everything I wrote here, and you can think of specific scenarios where my advice isn't the best. This letter is supposed to help the greatest number of people under the greatest number of situations. If you don't like my work, don't nitpick. Just sit down and explain chemical, nuclear, and biological warfare in a document about 3 pages long yourself. This is how we, the people of the United States, can rob these people of their most desired goal, your terror. I should interject that I am a licensed physician practicing here in the state of California, and I've been to several conferences lately where issues related to chemical, nuclear, and biological warfare and terrorism have been discussed, and I think that I must take my hat off to Sergeant Thomas for indeed summarizing in three pages in a very practical and sensible way what you, the citizenry, can do. If you look at the headlines, there's an awful lot of a lot of stuff going on that scares you. I mean, I've got a clipping in front of me, Al-Qaeda on brink of bioterror. I also have Newsweek, dated March 17th, the cover picture of Saddam Hussein, titled Counterattack, Biological Weapons and Urban Warfare, How Saddam Might Fight Back. I'd like to remind you on this program, we've talked about this issue. We talked about it with Dr. Wheelis, and I don't think there is any overwhelming, compelling evidence that Saddam Hussein has biological weapons and that he's prepared to use them. And we talked about smallpox. I think we talked a bit about anthrax. I think in spite of this Newsweek cover story designed to strike terror into the hearts of Americans, I think this is a much overblown threat. And again, thank you, Sergeant Thomas. At this point, I'd like to return to our talk with UC Davis microbiologist Mark Wheelis, an infectious disease and biological weapons expert who is frequently consulted by the news media. Dr. Wheelis is a member of the Federation of American Scientists and is part of its Biological Weapons and Toxins Verification Program. 2 weeks ago, Dr. Wheelis gave us a very fascinating talk, primarily concerned with biological weapons, but we did talk a bit about chemical weapons. And since Red Thomas didn't address incapacitating agents, and Dr. Wheelis did, this would be an excellent thing to join in this segment. I should preface this by saying that Dr. Wheelis has published a paper demonstrating that so-called non-lethal agents are not that at all. You would expect to have numerous fatalities with their use. But I opened by asking him about these non-lethal agents, which are illegal to use one nation against another, but which many nations wish to retain for domestic use.
The Chemical Weapons Convention is another arms control treaty that is very similar to the Biological Weapons Convention, but it controls all toxic chemicals. Toxic chemicals are considered to be chemical weapons unless they're used for one of four specific peaceful purposes, or at least non-chemical weapons associated purposes. One of those purposes is law enforcement. And so, for instance, riot control agents, tear gas and the like, are legal when they're used to control in domestic riot control. The wording of the Chemical Weapons Convention states that law enforcement, including domestic riot control, is not a prohibited use. So that leaves open the use of chemicals other than riot control agents for other law enforcement purposes besides riot control. Probably the most obvious example of that would be chemicals used for judicial execution. The United States wanted to retain the flexibility to use the gas chamber. So that's one of the reasons for that kind of wording. But it has also been applied most recently in the case of the Soviet hostage of the Russian hostage rescue in October 2002, in which the Russian special forces pumped large quantities of a narcotic opiate related to probably a veterinary anesthetic into the theater where the hostage takers were keeping something on the order of 750 or so hostages. The intent was to put everybody to sleep, and then the rescuers could storm into the theater without the risk that the hostage takers would blow themselves and their hostages up. In the actual event, over 120 hostages died of opiate overdoses, and of course all of the hostage takers were shot dead while they were comatose. So it's this kind of use which is technically legal under the Chemical Weapons Convention, but which raises a lot of issues for a number of arms control analysts. First of all, clearly these weapons are not non-lethal. Maybe sometime in the future we'll be able to develop truly non-lethal knockout chemicals, but at the present time, pharmaceutical science knows of no such chemicals with any potential like that. Secondly, the fact that a country can have a stockpile of this kind of chemical for law enforcement purposes raises the possibility that if they get into a military situation where they want to use such chemicals, they will use them. The United States has a long history of using non-lethal chemicals. We used riot control agents, principally tear gas, in Vietnam in a very large way.
I didn't know that.
Oh, we used, from 1966 to 1969, we used close to 10,000 tons of tear gas.
Wow.
It was dispensed by everything from hand grenades to aerial bombs to bulk dispensers and helicopters. The principal use was to get enemy troops out into the open where they'd be more vulnerable to either rifle fire or artillery fire or aerial bombing.
Wasn't that in contravention of the Geneva Convention, 1925?
Virtually every country in the world except the United States believed that. But the United States has long considered that riot control agents are not chemical weapons. And we even interpret the Chemical Weapons Convention that way. And we are, in fact, prepared at this moment, I believe, to deploy riot control agents in Iraq. It hasn't been announced, but there's plenty of evidence that the president has signed an order that permits that and that delegates to the field commander the authority to actually use these agents. Even more disturbing is testimony by a retired admiral to the Independent newspaper in the UK that U.S. Special Forces are equipped with what he called a knockout gas, which would probably be something like the fentanyl that was used in the Moscow theater rescue. And he speculated that the Special Forces would use them if they were useful weapons. There would be no doubt but what that would be a violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention. Actually, there's no doubt but what if the assertion that the Special Forces are so equipped, that's already a violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention. To use them would compound the violation. But the United States has been claiming for, since the Chemical Weapons Convention came into effect, that riot control agents do not fall under the rubric of toxic chemicals, despite the fact that they can kill people.
Dr. Wheelis, in summary, it sounds like your recommendation would be that international cooperation and transparency, basically not having clandestine programs, is something that will ultimately benefit the U.S. and the rest of the world.
I think it's the only hope for humanity to actually prevent a resurgence of interest in these weapons. Unfortunately, the United States military doctrine is premised on a requirement that the United States maintain technological superiority. So as long as it appears that these weapons are possible weapons that might be used against us, we may well have a vested interest in developing them ourselves. So I think that openness, transparency, and international cooperation give us the only hope in the long run for containing the threat that these weapons pose to us, both in the hands of other states and in the hands of terrorists, who, of course, are much, much more likely to be able to get their hands on this stuff if there are arsenals in the militaries of many nations.
Thanks again to bioweapons expert and UCD microbiologist, Dr. Mark Wheelis. You're listening to KDVS 90.3 FM. This is Radio Parallax. I'm Douglas Everett. Let's take another short break and then return for our third and final segment. We'll be right back.